Max jumped the
good
gun.
Energy. We had a false start.
Okay, here we are. This is officially the beginning of the Bitcoin, Presidio Bitcoin Jam.
Presidio Bitcoin Jam. Here it is. Very special day. Very special.
You're
buddies.
Drooping here. I got to get you up here.
Oh.
Okay.
Never be drooping. Absolutely
never
not.
Be drooping.
Never be drooping.
What's happening here? Why is there so much energy in the place today?
Why? We have a bunch of visitors from out of town today.
We do. And why do we have visitors from out of town, boys?
Presidio Bitcoin Hackathon.
Presidio Bitcoin Hackathon. PBHackathon.com,
baby.
All right.
We've talked about it several times. The time is
It's
now.
Actually happening now, right?
Yeah.
Like it's a few exciting. Hours. Is it 3-4 hours away now? It
starts tonight. Yeah. 5:36, something like that. So
it starts tonight. We have like 5 or 6 companies presenting their technology solutions, ranging from like Blocks presenting Goose and LightSparks here and Albi. And Fusats and Lexi.
Yeah.
And big prizes. Isn't there like 10 million Bitcoin being given away? Is that right?
Half and all of all the supply?
Something like that.
Something like
that. We need to rebase the units to get to that number.
Over $10,000, which if you're already rebased, which I heard Mr. Jack Dorsey may be rebased, I don't know, according to Noster.
He seems converted this morning.
Did you influence that at all? Like, because he sort of referenced your pointing it out.
Well, what I sent him a link to our show.
Mm-hmm.
And he watched that segment from December.
Yeah.
When we were just the Bitcoin Jam before the Presidio Bitcoin Jam.
Right.
And he liked our discussion. It persuaded him.
I'm glad we went from BJ to PBJ.
The context was we were talking about was it Steak and Shake.
Which is happening.
Yeah. So we can briefly talk about that. Steak and Shake, you know, I think maybe we talked about it last week, but they announced.
We weren't sure if it was real, though. It's real.
Yeah. It turns out it's real.
It's real. So I think the first payment was done yesterday in Bitcoin. And so someone posted a photo of the receipt.
Yeah.
And super cool moment, exciting. I noticed on the receipt, it said Lightning. It said Bitcoin. It said Sats. Like all these terms. And I'm just like, let's keep it cleaner. Bitcoin. Everyone knows. Everyone in the world has heard of Bitcoin. It's a great brand.
Very Justin Timberlake. Yeah.
It's a great brand.
Is that what inspired
right?
the tweet?
Yeah. Of course. Great movie. But Bitcoin's a great brand. Everyone's aware of it.
Yeah.
People's knowledge of what Bitcoin is growing every year. But like everyone is aware of that brand. Like no one knows what Sats are, Lightning, only the people probably watching the show.
Nerds.
And the people working on Bitcoin know that. But so keep it simple. So that I got a response from Jack. He wanted to introduce bits as a standard. And I'm like, no, bro.
Well, you were like a micro bits guy for a while.
I was. I was a bits guy. Like back in 2017, 2018 era, I was a bits guy.
Mm.
I think Adam Back liked it then, and I liked the notion because I thought we needed a stepping stone until the core unit of Bitcoin is in the code is, you know, one of 2.1 quadrillion units, right? But in 2017, 2018 era, it was like $1 million Bitcoin seemed a long ways away.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like, you know, yeah, we can get there, but it's a long, long ways away. So I thought I was a fan of bits as a stepping stone until we could get to the point where one unit was actually like worth roughly a penny or whatever. And $1 million Bitcoin is one penny is one unit of Bitcoin. Today, some apps call it sats. I think it should be called Bitcoin. But in any case, so had, sent Jack our segment, made a few other arguments and as to why, while it's an enormous hurdle to change the whole ecosystem, why it's the best for Bitcoin and best for users. And apparently he got persuaded.
Yeah. And didn't Coinbase or somebody, one of the big exchanges at one point actually tried to do this transition and then backed it out? Does that sound familiar?
I don't remember this. No.
I don't think so.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Maybe it didn't happen. Must have been my dream.
I do think it's also important because I obviously have not been as big of a proponent as you guys. I would say I'm kind of somewhere in the middle. Like if it happens, cool. If it doesn't, cool. But I will say if you get a few companies to do it together, like for example, if Cash App and Coinbase made the switch together, I think it would happen like overnight.
Michael Rahani tweeted saying he's liked this for years. So
it's pretty cool.
There we go.
And he was both, right? He was formerly Cash App, currently Coinbase.
He's made the rounds. He was a Bitcoin advocate at Apple, part of Apple Pay. Oh, he's a Bitcoin advocate at Tesla, Bitcoin advocate on Cash App, and now a Bitcoin advocate at Coinbase.
I believe he was instrumental in getting Elon to actually buy that Bitcoin. So shout out to Michael. Two things I want to mention off that. One on the Steak and Shake?
Steak and Shake, yeah.
Steak and Shake. I've never actually seen one of these, but I presume it's real. The one video I did see was of Evan Kaloudis doing a payment with Zeus. Just like, can we just pause for a moment? How badass is it that like a major chain is accepting Lightning payments and a cypherpunk with his cypherpunk wallet, self-custodial on his phone, made a payment to buy Steak and Shake? That's crazy.
And it actually worked.
And it actually worked. So
we still need to get NFC going, but there's folks working on that as well.
Yeah.
Did anybody hear any more rumors about why Steak and Shake did this? Is this like a publicity stunt or some ideological thing? Or
don't know. Would love to know though.
I would love to hear like the story behind this.
Because yeah. I'd like to hear the story. I'd like to understand the expectations they have, right?
Yeah.
Is it like a publicity stunt? Do they actually expect many people to pay? Like in 1 year's time, what percentage of volume or number of customers are paying in Bitcoin? Like, what's their expectation? Mine actually is still pretty low expectations. I think it's a super cool moment. It's still the kind of use case that I think is lower value, but except, you know, they might be doing it to lower their own fees. There is a strong value proposition there.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So if that is their, so again, yeah, I agree. What's their story? What's their motive? Is it ethos or is it like a business strategy and a marketing strategy? And if they really do want to lower their fees, then they might offer a lot of incentives and do a ton of marketing mm-hmm. to get consumers to convert to using Bitcoin. That would be incredible.
Also, I assume we don't know if they're like publicly held or privately kind of closely held.
I assume private, but I don't know.
Cause isn't one of the chains, is it Chick-fil-A? One of the chains has some sort of ideology and some religious stuff behind it.
Chick-fil-A is Deep South.
But is Steak and Shake not Christian? Not like that either?
I have no idea.
Because I wonder if it is like these things grew up from these small families or whatever, and they have an ideology and they just want to express that, maybe. Yeah.
It's very possible. I also wonder, to your point, if in addition to saving on fees, if you're becoming a Bitcoin treasury company, it might be, especially if you're a public company, but more palatable, even if you're a private company, to other stakeholders to be like, hey, man, I'm not going to buy Bitcoin, but any Bitcoin payments we get, we just save in Bitcoin. Maybe mm-hmm. that's like another way to kind of like back into the treasury.
Mm-hmm.
So also, I thought it was interesting to your point, like I wasn't expecting, you know, Bitcoin payments to pop off and like sort of mainstream usage. I'm still much more bullish on AI or digital, you know, resources. Having said that, at Lit Devs last night, we had a Lit Devs at PBJ or Presidio Bitcoin, which was awesome. I mean, I was shocked to see it's not just Stake and Pay. They were talking about Ellen Bits partnering with a...
Stake and Pay.
Whatever.
Like the rebrand.
Shake and Stake, Stake and Shake. You know what it is. But some like major grocery chain in Europe that's now accepting Lightning payments.
Shore, was it? Store?
I forget the name of the...
S-H-O-R, S-T-O-R. I'd not heard of it, but yeah, I think it's a popular chain.
Like, you know, what's our one here in the marina?
Safeway.
Yeah, like a Safeway in Europe. Anyways, point is, like, it does seem like there's like a bit of a moment happening for mainstream payments,
but you know, that moment existed in 2013 era as well, right?
Yeah.
So we shouldn't, I mean, it should be measured enthusiasm. There's no doubt that today versus 10 years ago, orders of magnitude more people owned Bitcoin.
Totally.
So they actually already, it's one hurdle. There's many hurdles to get to spending, right? And the first one is you have to own Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Way more people own Bitcoin today. Two, just the user experience, the applications, the payment experience needs to get better. And it's way better today than 10 years ago. So those are two wins. And then we talked about a few weeks ago on the show about the tax situation, at least in the US, where we might be looking at by the end of the year where you don't have to pay capital gains taxes when you spend.
That would be massive. So yes.
But on a limited amount, right? Like on $600 or
$600 or something.
Yeah. Not your Ferrari.
BK has a Ferrari. Hey, no. Wow. Paid for a Bitcoin? What?
No. Come on.
David's had a Prius most of his life.
That's true.
Oh, man.
So, but he has really nice bicycles. Uh-huh.
Very, bikes are
very good taste
in
bicycles.
Yeah, fair enough.
But anyway, a lot of the hurdles 10 years ago have been overcome or like major progress on. So we might be there, but we might not.
Yeah. No, it's fair enough. Regardless, it's cool to see it happening. I didn't expect it. So,
yeah.
And I'm glad to see that it's real because I think there's like videos of these things happening now. I think, did David Bailey just tweet that he's going to buy the first 10 people who show him his receipt on Twitter is going to buy him dinner?
I didn't know that.
I saw that. Nice.
Yeah.
It's a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's kind of cool that it's like, it's real. I don't know why. I want to hear more about why and the story behind it, but it's really happening.
And the power of magic internet money. I mean, this is what we see people do this on Nostr all the time. Like, hey, I'll buy you a drink, show me the receipt, click zap, send you the money. Like, it's very cool.
So I love to see it as a marketing moment, but I still think like Bitcoin is for these use cases we don't even really know or see yet. And so getting super hung up on cheering it when it works or, you know, hating it when it doesn't, it's kind of like, okay, you know, this too will pass. This is cool. But also kind of what really matters is, can we invent the new ways that require Bitcoin that don't even work unless you have an internet native money?
Which I would hope would start tonight.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. I hope by tomorrow night, we're going to have the top five projects from, we're going to have like 35 to 40 builders here.
Yep.
We'll see tonight how many teams form.
Mm-hmm.
You know, probably what?
10 to 20.
10 to 20.
Yeah.
10 to 20 teams will form. The top five will do a live stream demonstration tomorrow night. And let's see what they cook up. And, you know, I think there's going to definitely be some compelling Bitcoin payment applications, but for each of them, we should ask, like, you know, why Bitcoin?
Yes.
Versus dollars, for example. And hopefully we learn.
Yeah.
What are you guys most excited about for the hackathon? Anything in particular you want to see?
I want to see games. I just feel like games are like the best substrate to just play and have fun and do stuff. And you can invent new games and new mechanics around an internet native money.
Yep.
That you just couldn't have before. So yeah, paywall, that's fine. But also weird things where you like have like prediction markets and betting and different kinds of prize pools and stuff. There's so much that can be done when you have this internet money. And they're like these closed systems where like the whole thing is about having the fun and having the moment and doing it. So it's like, to me, that feels like a really fertile area that is like mostly underexplored. We've had some really good demos and stuff, but I think there's just like insane amount of progress to be made around that. And then that demonstrates to people this gets them thinking about other more utilitarian use cases.
Yeah. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I'll describe some areas, but because I want to see something I've not thought of, it's hard to say like, oh, this is what I want to see. Like, I don't know what I don't know. But I, you know, exploring AI payments and like, you know, with AI agents and what are some like useful payment situations? And again, where Bitcoin, the permissionless nature of Bitcoin wins, or, you know, the AI doesn't have to fill out a form and with this identity or something, you know, something compelling there. I think micropayments remain underexplored, even though it's been a concept for decades.
Yep.
And, you know, I think there's a common sentiment that, oh, micropayments create too much friction for end users. They don't want to think about making it. They don't want to make economic decisions for every like half penny or something.
Mm-hmm.
Totally agree. But that's not the only way to create micropayments for users. It can largely be hidden.
Yeah,
I mean, streaming sats for podcasts or whatever is one example, right? You're not like literally clicking, making a choice every second as you're listening, right? So, but
unless you're listening to us right now, in which case, go ahead, click through as much as you want.
But we, I still think it's really underexplored. I think we will see micropayment killer use case at some point, and maybe we'll discover it in the next 24 hours.
Yeah. I want to shout out a few things that I'm like you, obviously. I don't know what I don't know. So I'm excited to see something that blows my mind. That would be my dream. But I did another shout out I want to give. I'm very excited about this morning. I dropped a podcast on Ideas from the Edge with Dhruv Bansal. Dhruv, by the way, have you guys seen some of his talks over the years?
Yeah, you've sent me. Yeah.
I think Dhruv, like in a world of great thinkers, I think Dhruv might be my absolute favorite Bitcoin. He is next level. Thinking about where things are going many decades out, about AI, about energy, about one day Bitcoin on Mars. Yeah. A lot of incredible
things. That's what I was going to say. So I've read that several years ago, he wrote about that, right?
And it's really good.
Yeah.
So anyway, so in this, we talked a lot about AI. And I think two things that came out for me, one you guys know that I'm really excited about, which is this idea of autonomous life. Can we get private keys running within the secure enclaves or AIs that are interacting with each other without human intervention? I don't know if we're going to see that this weekend. That's probably a little bit too much of a push, but maybe we'll see something close. That would get me excited. And two, the thing that Dhruv was talking about, which sadly may not be palatable for your friendly neighborhood VC, but is the golden age of piracy. And I think his giant point was that I think we could see kind of like what the late 90s was on steroids, once you can have streaming micropayments for things like incentivized torrents, and eventually taking that out to actually meter and pay for bandwidth in real time. I also thought a little bit about this yesterday. I won't dox who it was, but I was trying to meet the runner of an eccentric and fun node, and accidentally introduced myself to the wrong guy. who showed me he was doing something with mesh networking, sending Nostr messages over, like, I think it was some kind of mesh-tastic. I think that's what he called it, some mesh protocol. And I was like, who the fuck is this? But it was fascinating. And then I started thinking, oh my God, now if you could now attach with this message a tiny payment, one Bitcoin, one sat for those who are not yet inducted, then all of a sudden you can actually pay and incentivize people to run these, you know, mesh radios or ham radios or whatever frequency you want to use. I think that, like, metering for the distributed infrastructure in real time is radically underexplored as well.
Yeah. And we've tried this. I mean, I used to run a thing called, do you know Phone, F-O-N? No. It was like a Wi-Fi mesh router where you could like share it with people who wander by on the street in your neighborhood.
Yeah.
And then that kind of thing was tried again with the shitcoin and Helium.
Yeah.
Right. Yep. So that idea kind of has come back again and again over the course of, like, you know, I call it, must be 15 years ago, maybe, when I was first playing with that. So it's an idea that's like, it's going to happen. It's just the timing, right? And we may be at a good...
I'm a little skeptical of it, but let's say we should queue that up for another show.
Yeah, maybe this one.
Because I'm skeptical, but I'd love to learn more. I want to become a believer in that model.
No, so we should do a deep dive. One last question on that. How did Phone, were people just doing it altruistically or were they getting paid?
There was a payment mechanism. You could have a subscription to the thing, and then you have a subscription at your house and you get paid when people use yours. So you kind of net out what you would have otherwise paid for the subscription. Okay. So you kind of get like a rebate when other people use yours. So if you just put it in a useless place, you don't get any of the rebate. If you put it on a busy street, you do. But I just think the idea of like how we get internet access might be able to be made more efficient. It may not be that you have cable going to your home and a Wi-Fi thing. Maybe everybody has a Starlink-like thing, right? So
yeah.
It's not like inevitable in the sense that, like, I think it's inevitable that we have more efficient ways to get internet bandwidth, and probably Bitcoin payments could be a part of that, just like it probably becomes a part of every piece of infrastructure, whether it's like, you know, the database you're using or the energy you're using to power the data center. All of it probably gets mediated through Bitcoin, but I wouldn't say that like it's the Wi-Fi access point at your home that necessarily is the kind of routing point for those payments.
Yeah, fair.
So we love audience engagement. So
yeah.
Rob Hamilton says happy Friday, gents. Hey, Rob.
What's up?
Glad
from
to have
AnchorWatch, right?
Yes.
And I think I saw they just made a big hire.
Oh, they did.
Uh-oh.
Sorry, I don't have the actual news in front of me, but sure. I saw, I think Rob was talking about a big hire they made today. So congrats, Rob, on the hire.
You remember the name?
Yeah.
Sorry, I don't. I can look it up.
It's okay. All
right. I'm sure it was big.
Knowing Rob, I'm sure it would be big. I'm guessing Rob wants to hear us talk about the block Bitcoin blockchain and fees and like different use cases and stuff.
Yep.
Should we start with Coinbase though?
Because okay.
I think we can cover Coinbase in like 5 minutes.
Just wait.
And then we'll get to the meaty topic.
Shitcoiner is going to shitcoin. Is that how I say?
So we'll cap how much time we spend on Coinbase.
Okay.
Coinbase.
Mitch
Kochman as our head of growth. Yeah. Okay. Congrats.
Sweet.
All right. Great. Thank you.
I knew he would know.
I would certainly hope.
Well, we're a phone-free show. We're not... early episodes, we're like all behind our laptops and I was like doing work while we're on the show and not even like listening to you guys.
Did I let that slip? Appreciate that attention. Wow. It's so much better in person.
So much better in person.
Yeah.
What happened with Coinbase?
Well, okay, so I'm teed up. Coinbase, I think what it was there was an exploit, like a social engineering exploit of some of the customer service people who I think were based in the Philippines, and they were able to get a bunch of customer data. It wasn't private keys, it wasn't customer funds, but it was maybe stuff like social security number, blinded credit card numbers or something.
Address.
Partially blinded. Yeah, home address. So a bunch of data got leaked out, and then I think the people who executed the hack demanded $20 million ransom payment from Coinbase. And my understanding is Brian Armstrong, CEO of Coinbase, came out and said, we're not paying the ransom, but we are going to give a $20 million bounty to anybody who gives information about the, you know, the hacker.
So leading to the arrest and conviction.
Arresting
of the criminals.
Yep.
Yep.
Yep. Yeah. So several threads here. One is, I think it's undeniable that was like pretty bad operational practices by Coinbase. There's no way a customer service representative, wherever they're located in the world, should have access to all of this customer data. Sadly, I think this is probably quite common among companies. I mean, I highly doubt like only Coinbase had bad practices, right, and every other company is, you know, all
buttoned
up.
But to
do
customer service, you often need to be able to investigate a situation, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but like,
but there can be controls. There can be controls put in place, right? Like, you shouldn't be able to just access the entire database. So another thread here, though, is that they communicated less than 1% of some acronym I've never heard of. It sounds like
monthly transacting
unit or
something. Yeah, that's what I thought too.
So, but what is it? What do you think
it's
for?
Monthly transacting users. Yeah. It's kind of like a monthly active type.
I've never seen that used before. So my interpretation of that is like the legal and comms team worked to come up with some new metric to minimize what this sounds like. What we do know is that they have an SEC filing saying that they expect this to be $180 to $400 million cost. And
damn,
not because funds were stolen yet, but if they, part of Brian Armstrong's message to customers is like, if you were socially engineered and lose your Bitcoin, we'll reimburse you. And so they're estimating the expense of that to be up to $400 million. Mm-hmm. Now, the less than 1%, I either think that's like not true.
Yeah.
Or it's like basically 1% of their highest, you know, they're whales, basically.
Yeah.
Because I did, I'm not going to dox anyone, but I asked a bunch of people, did you get the email? Right. And like way more than 1% of the people I asked said yes. So the 1% number doesn't really line up. But the people I asked, you know, they were early Coinbase customers. They had a high balance back in the day. I don't think any of them have Bitcoin there anymore, though. Right. But, you know, so who exactly was impacted? At minimum, I suspect it's a lot of Bitcoin. If you sum up the Bitcoin of the people who were impacted is high.
Yeah.
So that's scary in terms of like potential. I mean, there'll undoubtedly be daily phishing attacks. I was part of the Ledger attack back when I was naive, like most humans, and I gave Ledger my home address. And then that got exposed and my, you know, email and phone. And now I'm a hardened soul. Like I know, or first of all, I don't give that information out anymore. And then secondly, I'm getting spam or, you know, I'm getting phished every day. But I also notice those phishing attacks get more and more sophisticated.
Yes.
So I do wonder at what point, you know, am I, you know, I'm like knowledgeable about it, aware of it, ready for it, hardened. But when am I going to fall victim to that?
Especially as you go up against AIs, right? Like the nature of the attacks, I think this is what's so scary is like, you know, as we see AI coming to take off or whatever you want to call it, like I think in a year from now, you know, if you wanted to have like a simulated video call with someone you really think it's there, they could do that.
Yeah. So super scary. So another subtopic here is just KYC data. And one thing that a lot of Bitcoiners believe in is that, you know, the Bank Secrecy Act in the United States from like back when I was born, has more costs than benefits to society. It's like an overall bad public policy. And then everything that's come from that, and then we see it in the EU and sort of all over the world, collecting all this personal information when you want to create a bank account. Of course, Bitcoin, the way it's built, doesn't require that information.
You know, was the Bank Secrecy Act originally created to solve a specific problem that was on people's minds because of a big public policy issue or some blow up?
I don't know the history. I'm sure there was some.
Nick Carter's probably written about that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I don't know specifically. But anyway, I mean, it just, this is just yet another example of a data leak where customers are harmed and people are harmed.
Mm-hmm.
Or there's the potential for harm. I mean, we absolutely know they're going to get phished. Now, whether there's going to be wrench attacks and people attacking homes, well, I hope not. But maybe, but definitely people will be phished and definitely people are going to be tricked. We've seen this that pattern over and over and over again. Unfortunately, people are quite vulnerable, but smart people, who are accomplished in life, get tricked. And as we just said, like it's getting more and more sophisticated where almost no one will be able to defend themselves against it. So it raises that topic as well. And it's just yet another example. I really hope that policymakers incorporate this into their calculus as to what's the right thing for consumers. I mean, because like they're trying, you know, there's definitely tons of financial fraud, like just absolutely outright criminal behavior that everyone would agree is like bad behavior and should be policed and punished, and that, terrorism, et cetera. But I don't think they've incorporated like the 99.9% of people who are just fine, ethical,
right?
You know, people going about their lives who didn't ask for this. And then they're burdened. I mean, identity theft already is a massive burden. It affected my mom. It like caused her tons of stress, and she had to spend weeks and weeks and weeks like solving it. And I don't know if she ever did address the problem because someone else with the same name, or I forget, it was someone else with the same name, or someone like stole her identity, and it just caused her all kinds of issues. So, yeah. Anyway, that's a subtopic. Brian Armstrong's response, I think a lot of people are saying, you know, giving that a thumbs up. It was a rapid response. It was a strong response. So I think I'd agree with that. So I think that was job well done. But still, we have to acknowledge, like, Coinbase didn't have good operations here.
That you really can have any type of airtight operations, because you have to enable your customer service people to be able to like search for a record when somebody shows up and be able to deal with the customer service issue. So how do you ultimately, like, I think it's an unsolvable problem.
But you don't give them the option of like download the top, you know, million customer names in one.
I don't know if that option was available or there was some other type of hack.
You can put controls in place.
But do we know which controls they had in place and which
there's
they
also
don't?
A lot of data that is you're legally required today to keep if you're a regulated company. So one option you have is just like skirt the law and like give the finger and be like, no, we want to do what's right for customers. A less extreme option is like you can take that data that isn't needed for customer support and put it like in cold storage, like put it offline. So it's much harder to access. And like, because why would a customer support representative need to know a social security number and home address? Yeah. Like, there's certain cases where you need a home address, but many you don't. So again, you can put controls in place. That can be like an exceptional situation.
I want to offer a slightly different take on where I think this would make me go. So two things. One, I agree with you. At the limit, you can never completely get rid of this risk. You can definitely do things to mitigate it. You can make it harder for customer service reps to get that information. So one, I do hope we start to see this maybe as a extra kick to get something like a local Bitcoins or a decentralized exchange on Nostr going much stronger, higher velocity. Like, I actually think it's really important for safety and for people to have that option. But number two, Brian Armstrong, I mean, I have mixed feelings on the guy. Like, I agree his response was strong. I think it's great that he didn't pay the ransom. He's going after them. I think he's done some good things in the past. But every time you hear that guy, I just can't help but think, like, to your point, it's always very kind of like tricky corporate speak, 1%. You never know where he's really coming from. Obviously, we've talked about the risks of, yes, they're like a traditional fiat company. They've hired a good security team. But because they're supporting all the other coins besides Bitcoin, how secure is the Bitcoin really in the long run? I want to just also take a moment to say, if someone is using a centralized exchange, I've seen this crazy so many times, but like Leishman is just the idea. Like, and I guarantee you, the more I watch all this play out, I know Coinbase is a huge head start, but in 50 years, Leishman, as he tweeted as a joke, but it's true, he tweeted that Coinbase had the opportunity to build JP Morgan and they built Caesar's Palace. Leishman's building JP Morgan. Like, you listen to Armstrong, you listen to Leishman, it's just night and day.
Let me tell you a story. And David already knows the story. So David and I have a group chat with a mutual friend from long ago. And he owns Bitcoin. And I think he originally had Bitcoin on Coinbase. And then, through years of pestering and making arguments and stuff, I think he self-custodies a portion of his Bitcoin. Yeah, and I think he moved the rest from Coinbase to River.
Good move.
Right. So, somewhat surprising to me last night was that I raised awareness of this Coinbase ransom and just everything we just talked about with in this group chat, and he responded saying like, I don't like the response of this Leishman guy.
Really?
And he's now moving his Bitcoin from River back to Coinbase, despite the whole context of this being like,
why?
He didn't like the, do you remember the phrasing?
Well, I forget the phrasing, but it was effectively, I think Leishman said, that's why we pay our customer support people a good wage or something. His sort of retort to why Coinbase was failing is not something that he's actually immune to, something he's still subject to.
Yeah.
And he just says, like, we pay better.
Well,
like, that's
I think it's more nuanced than that. And this is where I was going to go with this. I think Leishman's point was the bigger your team gets, the more attack surface there is, right?
So true. Yeah.
I didn't hear the like pay better, although that's certainly implied. But his takeaway from my perspective is if you have a smaller team, and I think, by the way, the best companies are not, you know, going to be playing the old hyperscaling game of any 1,000, 10,000 employees. Like, I think Leishman's point is if you have a team of 30 people and they're superstars and you write enough software to automate everything and you focus, and again, that's the key of focusing only on Bitcoin, not on the shitcoins, then you can, you know, do a lot more personal verification with people higher. I'm not saying he's immune from it. And like, obviously, like they're a much smaller scale. And I think he gave Brian Armstrong the props he deserved. But I agree entirely. Like, it's also, and like, maybe your friend doesn't see this and that's totally fine. It's his perspective. But like, it's a culture thing. When you hire people that are there working at Caesar's Palace, like, I'm sorry, it's not the same as hiring.
I think our friend's point, I don't think it was really about like where the customer support agent is. It was more, he didn't like the tone, or he got the impression that River's like just really second fiddle, like a little guy compared to Coinbase, which is true.
And Leishman would say.
But I mean, I'm not saying I agree with my friend. In fact, I mean, David saw my responses. I'm like, this is crazy. Like,
I don't think internet dunking is a quality I admire.
Yeah.
That was a quote.
Well, yeah. So I would suggest going with the real security, but
yeah.
We'll
share this
for the record, by the way.
I loved it. I think Leishman's like the generational CEO. So
for the record, among us, I'm the only non-River bag holder.
I'm a fan of Leishman.
I'm a fan of River. But I don't think any centralized exchange can be immune to these kinds of problems. So I think they're doing the best job possible, but it's still get off the exchanges is the only real answer.
I agree. And that was my point. First point of like, we need to see a DEX first. But in every decision I've watched for, you know, since 2017, Leishman is just, he's done everything I would have done. So that's all I can say.
He's doing a great job.
But plus one to your comment, David.
Yeah.
Yep. Anything else on Coinbase? I think...
What else?
DK wishes he was a River bag holder.
I should have. Yeah. I mean, you know, Steve kindly introduced me and didn't make the move. But what else on Coinbase? What else is they were just added to the S&P 500?
Yep.
Right. So it's kind of like,
so I don't know if the timing of this hack was like strategic or what, but kind of like a given the middle finger right after they got added to the S&P 500. But
yeah,
that's a big milestone though for them and cryptocurrency.
So. Yep. And notably, the hackers wanted Bitcoin.
They got Brian Armstrong to say Bitcoin. That's a win.
So yeah, down for the cause.
We talked about loan products last week, including Coinbase, and then I think a Twitter discussion. I think that followed that episode. I forget when, but you know, someone pointed out, because I think we said in the show that like Lava is the only solution that where you self-custody your Bitcoin, like in a native way.
Right.
And that, you know, so no other solutions do, including Coinbase. But then someone tweeted like with a screenshot of some kind of Coinbase marketing material saying that it's self-custody. So I asked some folks that I know at Coinbase if there's more context to that.
Yeah.
And I did get a response. It's an ongoing conversation, so I'll keep updating here as I learn more. But I think by that, they're wrapping Bitcoin in CBBTC.
Yeah.
So by my definition, it is definitely not self-custody. Right. Like the customer who's taking the loan does not have control of the keys to their Bitcoin anymore. But then with the tokens you get and the ensuing contract, smart contract, that can be held
in a self-custody. CBBTC. Well,
yeah.
And self-custody, which is like an oxymoron.
Exactly.
I mean, to be fair, that marketing message is common within the Bitcoin world too. People who have wallets that use Blockstream Liquid call that self-custody. And, you know, LightSpark's calling Spark self-custody. And I think, you know, there's reasons behind that that aren't nefarious.
Yeah.
So I don't like to make a big stink about it.
Yeah.
But I think it's really important.
It's nuanced.
Because it's nuanced. It's not as simple as like it is either fully self-custody or fully custodial. There's all kinds of area in between. What really mattered, the nuance is that trust. Yes. How much trust is there? And what,
correct.
What am I trusting you about? Am I trusting you with my privacy? Am I trusting that you can freeze funds, that you could steal funds? There's all,
and can you unilaterally move against an individual versus just like
the whole system? Exactly. So there's so much nuance, and that's, unfortunately, the devil's in the details, and that's really where we need to improve education. So when people use a product, they know what trade-off they're making.
Yes.
Most of these solutions on the table, they're not in and of themselves bad, but if customers are misled to thinking they're trusting this institution less than they think they are, not as much as they actually are, then that's a bad situation. So as long as there's transparency, that's what we need to call for.
I think that was our takeaway for all of these products is transparency. And for every individual user, if you're going to use one of these products, just make sure you can answer in general, I always like to say for anything you're doing, if you're investing or whatever, like drop all of the jargon, any complexity, like explain it like you're five. You can't say like very simple terms. Yeah. Here's the money. Here's who holds the money. Here's where the money comes from. Here's how the money comes back. Here's where I know the money is held. Super simple. If you can't answer those super simple questions, you're probably not ready to take it. I also just want to give a little bit of a follow-up to last week because we were talking about Lava. I just want to say that I was able to get it to work. A more meaningful situation and it was smooth. So, kudos to that team. They were really on top of stuff and I haven't, obviously, paid it back and gotten it all to work. So I can't, let's check back in a couple months.
You took delivery of the couch.
I did take delivery of the couch. Yes. Yes. So,
most Bitcoiners don't even have a chair and you have a couch.
I know.
I bet you can seat at least two people.
You also know I've been sleeping on the floor with no furniture for a long time. And I'm not even joking.
You got the couch. I mean, it's a brilliant solution. You got the couch and you didn't sell your Bitcoin.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah.
It's perfect. Yeah.
So I last tried Lava, I think in December. And there's so many amazing things about that experience that I'm excited for. Yeah. But I found a ton of bugs.
Yeah.
Like a combination of user experience bugs, which you can get past, but it's like, oh, this could be made much slicker,
and
more intuitive.
Scary if you're doing
and then some bugs where I just I couldn't transfer the stablecoin dollars to my bank account back then. So I actually tried it again this week. And unfortunately,
still bugs.
You guys saw the bugs I encountered, but I got a bunch of errors. I still can't add it to the bank account. So credit to Shazan though. He's got me connected with, I think, a dev on the team, and we'll get that resolved.
Yep.
So I remain really bullish on Lava, what the user experience going to become. And the kind of problems I'm finding, they're not fundamental. They're going to be hopefully fixed quickly. But and that experience that I know we're going to see, the ability to so quickly get a loan,
yeah,
have that trust minimization,
yeah,
is incredible. And then the only question is about the maturation process of the oracles and multiple oracles and big brands doing it. But there's no doubt that will happen if there's a real market there.
Yeah.
And then,
there's
definitely a market.
So for this to become a really big deal, the rates have to be reasonable and the durations have to be better than 30 days, 90 days. I don't even know where it's at now, but back in December, I think 30 days was the most.
I think there were 30 days.
I think it's
maybe
90 now or something.
Yeah.
And,
I think they actually have 6 months now.
Yeah. So that, as this market, if there's real demand, the rates are going to get better. The durations are, you're going to get more variety. And the security will just get better and better because there'll be multiple oracles and it'll be kind of pretty much airtight security.
I want 5% 30-year fixed. Then I'm all in.
Yeah.
I'll even take on a ton of leverage because I got 30 years.
Because you got a lot of couches to buy.
So should we, move to the big topic.
Let's do it.
The Bitcoin blockchain.
Okay.
Let's talk about it. Yeah.
So, we're on our third week now of talking about all the Bitcoin drama, but we're going to tackle it from a different angle.
Are you feeling at peace or are you kind of caught up in it right now?
I'm still engaging on it.
But it's not stressing you out.
It's not stressing me out.
Good.
It's exhausting, but exactly. I guess the high level points for me. One is that despite the unpleasantness of all this drama and bickering and people fighting with each other, people who are generally on the same team, Bitcoin and friends with each other are fighting with each other,
yeah.
is that I think thousands of people are being educated about the Bitcoin network and how it works in a way that they otherwise would not have prioritized
yep.
in their life, right? So, and that creates a stronger Bitcoin long-term if more and more people, we don't want an elite group of core devs
right.
as the only people in the world who understand how the system works.
Yeah.
Then we have centralization. But I mean, some, you know, there's a segment of people who think Bitcoin Core is like the centralization point. I don't think it is, but it would become one if there's only a group of like 30 devs who actually understand how the system works. So yeah. that's one high level point. And then the second one is that the way we solve this problem, I mean, it's my opinion, but I think you guys share it. And I think a lot of others do. The solution is that we need to drive adoption of Bitcoin usage and Bitcoin payments. Yeah. Bitcoin is money. We need to drive adoption as Bitcoin is money. And so there needs to be better development tools, better applications and products. We need to find product market fit. We need growth. So like the growth hire that Rob has for AnchorWatch, like he needs to drive growth of AnchorWatch. And every product out there needs to drive growth. When we see more usage of Bitcoin as money, guess what? More transactions in the blockchain will be Bitcoin as money. It'll drive the fees up. And because there's so much value for customers, they'll be willing to pay fees. And they will outprice other things. So to me, that's the two big things. All the other details are like completely in the weeds.
So let's
talk
about...
people care and the markets will...
People learn... People care slash learn more.
Out.
And like, yeah, and that...
We want real demand.
And then we need adoption of Bitcoin as money. Everyone, like, it's not this division of like, you know, half the people think Bitcoin is money and the other half don't think Bitcoin is money. The people who are on the other side also think Bitcoin is money.
Yeah.
They literally work 24/7 to make Bitcoin as money. So everyone agrees Bitcoin is money, but we need to drive adoption of Bitcoin as money.
And we drive adoption when we actually see transactions in the mempool. So I think this is something you were hinting that we should discuss today. And this also got brought up last night at Lit Devs, which I actually thought there was one interesting point there, which people have been talking about. The mempool is empty. And a lot of people say, well, that's because everything's moving to Lightning. And there's a whole bunch of different companies releasing that over the last year or so, you know, there are Lightning transactions. The percentage of total Bitcoin volume from on-chain to Lightning has increased by anywhere from, call it 10, 20, 30% in some cases. So that's great. But I'm still very skeptical because most of those are small payments anyway, that would like have a radical impact here. And probably a lot of those payments would not have gotten done otherwise if they had to be on the base chain. Maybe yes, maybe no. But regardless, if Bitcoin is going to succeed, let's say 2050, what do you think about what the mempool is going to look like? What is a transaction fee going to look like? Will people be using it at all for individual transactions? Will all of that be Lightning? Will there still be space for other kinds of data? What are y'all's best guess on what the mempool looks like in 2050?
Well, I mean, years ago, I did some napkin math on like, I was curious, what did transaction fees, the amount need to look like
mm-hmm.
for a given security budget?
Yep.
There's a professor at the University of Chicago, Eric Budish, who mm-hmm. wrote a paper in 2018. That argued that basically Bitcoin is going to fail because I forget the exact numbers, but I think he modeled out that transaction fees were going to have to be like $18,000 per transaction or just some like such a large, whatever the number was, it was so large that it was outrageous. And, you know, so a group of us met in Boston in fall of 2018 to discuss that paper and be, you know, like, is this the future, and are we like, is this a big LARP or is it wrong? And our conclusion was that I think it was like an earnest attempt by that professor. I don't think he like set out to like, you know, have a scathing report on Bitcoin. It was a reasonable model, but this is such a challenging problem that I one takeaway I had is like, you can't model this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So while it was a good attempt at a model, it was too simplistic. And we came up with at least four things that the model didn't account for, so that it kind of rendered the conclusion poor. But that got me to thinking about the security budget. How much do we need to pay miners to make Bitcoin secure? Another simplistic take, and actually part of that paper, was like, well, how much would it cost to acquire 51% of the hash rate for like a short period of time?
Mm-hmm.
like an hour or a few hours. And then people would go look at like a service like NiceHash, where you can rent GPUs. And there have been double spending attacks on other altcoins in the past.
Yeah.
Where you can rent hash rate, and B, you can rent enough that you can literally 51% attack these small chains. And they were successfully attacked. So it definitely can happen. Then people apply the same kind of numbers to Bitcoin and be like, oh, you only need like a few million dollars for a few hours and you can double spend Bitcoin. But it's if you look into this deeply, it's not that simple. Just the logistics of acquiring that are unrealistic. The only realistic way now would be if you attacked like 3 or 4 mining pool systems, or like, and this is credible. Like a hacker could attack 3 or 4 mining pool systems and take over those systems for a period of time and pull off a double spending attack. So if that occurred today, I would not be surprised. So that is an area where Bitcoin can improve over time. And then we can get into Stratum V2 and all these other systems to be able to do that. But even if that were the case, that would be like bad and a bad hiccup, but like they'd regain controls of the systems and they'd stop doing it. It would be very temporary. But in any case, the question is, how much security budget do we need? Because, I mean, another important point to make is historically, 99% of the revenue has come from the subsidy.
Yep.
Less than 1% has been fees. That of course, is going to flip over time. Obviously, at some point, it's 0% from subsidy, 100% from fees. But even in the next decade, we know the subsidy keeps going down in Bitcoin terms.
Although it will go up in
dollar terms. It goes up in dollar. So to date, the number go up aspect has, compensated miners quite well, but that obviously has to asymptote at some point. Mm-hmm. I mean, even if you believe in like number go up, you know, forever, Laura, right?
Yeah.
Which I think we do
yeah.
But not 100% per year forever, right? I think we talked about recently,
match GDP growth.
But
to be clear, that's after you reach like the stasis points. That's like well north of $10 million coin.
So. But the point is, there's going to be a huge transition in the dynamics of the business where fees are what miners are getting paid in.
Yep.
And so it goes from a function of like the price of Bitcoin is how much security budget we get. And we don't even know, do we need that security budget or not? Is it too high, too low, just right? We have no idea because it's a pretty independent variable of just like what people want to value Bitcoin at. So when we move to fees, though, it's a very different equation. That's the amount of money someone's willing to attach to a transaction to get it broadcast and mined. That's a very different question than how much I think Bitcoin's worth, right? Or that people think Bitcoin's worth. What is the security budget? It's a huge question. So I'm convinced there's no person knows the answer. There's no model that has the answer, but it's a really interesting topic to talk about. But then I also wanted to talk about like these different use cases on Bitcoin. Like for people who are concerned about spam on Bitcoin somehow hurting Bitcoin as money, that's a really legitimate topic. Even if you assume we can't stop the spam, it's still a legitimate question. Well, then are we fucked? Right?
Right.
Like we can't stop it. And then is it NFTs forever? Like in 2050, is the blockchain all NFTs and everyone around the world wants to use Bitcoin as money, but they can't? Let's talk about that, right? So what are you, I have a bunch of thoughts, but I'll let you guys start.
I mean,
what do you see the mix as in the future? And like, can there be both? And like, what do the economics look like?
I think, this is, like any networked system, this is a complex adaptive system. Exactly. And some people come in and do something that's in their interest and other people come in and do something that's in their interest. In trying to reason about exactly how all of those things interact with each other, it's kind of fun and it feels satisfying intellectually, but I think it's really hard to get to a reasonable prediction about what the actual final result will look like. So I'm a little bit of the camp of like, hey, let's play with it and try things and see and not try to imbue too much of our own opinion on it. And let's kind of see how it develops and see what people want. Like, I could be sympathetic to the idea that NFTs are spam, But I could also say, like, well, maybe they're just a transitional, economic utility that gets miners paid enough for the next 10 years until the energy price has changed and the number of miners and the hash rate has changed and the efficiency of the mining equipment has changed. And, like, there's so many variables that play into this that I think trying to make really strong definitive claims about exactly how it should be done is kind of a fool's errand. Now, what does it look like? Maybe it's NFTs for 5 years. And then maybe we realize that actually, not everybody in the world can deal with UTXOs and those become like a final settlement layer, but there's something in Lightning or eCash or other layers that play into how, like, what actually demands block space. And it may not be just like a transaction from me to you, but it may be several layers above that where that's actually happening.
I think there's two really important ideas when you think about technology, if you just zoom out for a minute. And I think this is something that a lot of people that are very ideologically motivated maybe miss because they're so ideologically motivated. And by the way, it can be ideologically motivated in the abstract or, like, to your point, in terms of time frame. For example, I think, like, the Bitcoin Cash guys, right, Bcash, they really wanted payments, and we're going to get payments. But, like, we weren't going to get them in 2017, and that was impossible, right? But we're going to get them maybe now, maybe in 2025. We finally have Bitcoin payments scaling in layers. So I would say, there's the danger of ideology in the abstract and the danger of trying to rush nature before it's ready to do what you want it to do. But the two key concepts I would encourage everyone to think about, and these are actually concepts I discussed deeply with Dhruv on that podcast I mentioned, is one, the idea that technology, not even the creator of a new technology knows what the technology is going to become. Yep. And this is an idea Kevin Kelly's talked about for decades. And the idea is, when you put something out in the world, you certainly have a certain amount of will or volition with it. But once it's in the world, it's no longer yours. It has a life of its own. And as a student of technology and the history of science and the history of technology, one of the most interesting things to do is to find what we talk about also as the beautiful surprise. When you put something out in the world to solve one problem, you may end up needing to solve a dozen of other supporting problems in order for that thing to work. In the case of Bitcoin, I think it's very interesting in that, in order to create peer-to-peer eCash, which is what Satoshi set out to build, you needed to build a clock. Why did you need to build a clock? Because that's the only way you can solve the double spins problem, is to build a global clock. That's what Bitcoin, that's one, I always feel like the guy, like, feeling the elephant, I feel the trunk, and the leg. It's like, that is one view of what Bitcoin is. It's a global clock. Great. But something else Dhruv talks about is, the Lightning Network. We set out to build a peer-to-peer payment channel network. So it's easy to do payments all around the world. But in actuality, what I think, I agree with him, what we're actually building is incentivized Tor. I think in decades, we're going to look back and say, literally, the Lightning Network is the way to sell bandwidth or tiny units of infrastructure for money, incentives. And no one saw that coming at first either. So what I would just encourage everyone to is to go in, instead of just stay humble and stack Bitcoin, stay humble and observe and see what Bitcoin wants to become. What Kevin Kelly says, what technology wants? What does Bitcoin want? And I think your point is very well taken, that that can change over time. Like, Bitcoin bootstrapped as payments on the dark web. Now, it's starting to invite other kinds of data. And I think it's going to go back to payments, but it's going to go in many, many layers to get there.
I think another important nuance, it's not all or nothing. I don't think you were intentionally framing it this way, but I don't think it's like, oh, for the next 5 years, it's all NFTs.
Right.
100% of the block space is NFTs. And then the next 5 years, 100% payments. It can be a mix. It is a mix today. It's been a mix forever. I mean, there's been like Satoshi dice in the past and like all kinds of different applications and like literal spam attacks. I guess when I say literal, I mean... spam that everyone would agree with. I just tweeted out before the show like five examples of what some might consider spam, and I just tossed out my estimates for like the percentage of Bitcoiners that think are spam. I'll just share it here if I can remember. NFTs, my guess is 80% of Bitcoiners think that's 90%. Spam. Oh, is it? Sorry, 90%. The second one, what was the second
decentralized namespace.
Right. Some people have explored
80%.
Like a new version of DNS that's decentralized.
And by some people, he means David King.
I didn't want to dox him, but other people do. I think
there's a lot of people who are,
But, Ethereum has ENS, right? And there's several proposals to do it on Bitcoin.
And I think Satoshi kind of gave nod to the fact that this was a
name coin
space to think about.
So, And, you know, I estimated 80% of Bitcoiners would consider that being spam. And then BitVM has this notion of like, for its zero knowledge proof system, like you can challenge, if you think the operators are cheating you, you can challenge it. And the size of that proof, I think, is like the size of the entire block or two blocks, or Robin or someone can correct me, but it's a huge amount of block space. So is that spam? Then like the current like debate is around Citria, which is a BitVM based company and service, using a Groth 16 zero knowledge proof, which that plus a little bit more data was on the order of 140, 150 bytes. So a small amount of data, you know, is that spam? And I think what I say, like 40% or 30% of people, again, these are just like estimates.
Yeah.
I'm actually curious what I hope people are responding to that to let me know what they think is spam. And then open timestamps was my fifth one.
Yeah, right? They had it like 10%.
10 or
like
20.
Most people think
20%, I think.
20%.
Okay. Anyway, who knows what the percentages are? But I mean, the point is, those are five examples of data that probably cause at least some Bitcoiners consternation that like this is spam, should not be in the blockchain. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, like personally, I think open timestamps seems pretty valuable in it. And again, and it's like, it's a tiny amount of block space. So I don't see it, open timestamps getting in the way of Bitcoin as money at all.
Yeah.
It's so efficient in how it uses mm-hmm. the block space. So I don't see like, I had issues with NFTs on Bitcoin. I have no issues with NFTs, the concept.
Right.
Yeah. I've said that multiple times over the years. And some Bitcoiners just hate NFTs, the concept. And mm-hmm. I actually don't understand that. Like, I collected baseball cards as a kid. Lots of humans collect coins and stamps and collections.
It's a religion.
This is not a new phenomenon. It's a proven phenomenon that people, human beings, like collectibles, having digital versions of them with scarcity makes complete sense to me. Now, which platform should it be built on? That's a really good question.
Yeah.
And a big concern I had with NFTs on Bitcoin is like, is it going to crowd out Bitcoin as money? Because what mm-hmm. I care about is Bitcoin as money.
Right.
If NFTs are going to fuck with that, then I'm like, I'm going to join the current mob on right. like no spam.
But there's like a distinction between, is the NFT, all of the visual data for the NFT stored as part of the blockchain, is all the visual data stored in a separate client outside that doesn't need to be synced with full nodes and just some sort of proof of it stored? Or is it some other?
I agree those are variations, together, right? But like, today, I mean, they are storing.
Yeah,
people
yeah.
are storing there's JPEGs are, on yeah. the blockchain, yeah, yeah. right? So there's value to that. You get permanency, although there's subtlety with that as well. If nodes prune it, then you have a data availability problem. Yeah. But in any case, I think we with what we understand of technology, we can't stop this, whether yep. you like it or not.
Yeah.
And so, but I also came to terms with, I don't think NFTs, even if they could become very popular, are going to crowd out Bitcoin as money. That's where I yep. arrived at. And the reason why I think, if we assume, I think for this to be an interesting discussion, we have to assume Bitcoin as money is super popular, and we have to assume NFTs are super popular, because if either are not popular,
yeah, yeah.
then it's not an yeah, interesting yeah. discussion. So if they're both really popular, I think NFTs will be stored on the Bitcoin blockchain in 2050, but it'll be like the Mona Lisas of the world, whatever the premium art is, because I never answered the question about modeling out Bitcoin transaction fees, but if we assume a security budget of $50 billion a year, which that's highly debatable and that's a really interesting conversation, but it's a reasonable assumption. let's just use that number because that's sure. And assume no block size increase and assume that we do the optimizations we know we can keep doing to Bitcoin transactions, it comes out to something like $200 fees per transaction mm-hmm. in, I think it was the year 2036, 2038, something like that, accounting for like, oh, and also the other assumption is $1 million Bitcoin. So if you assume $50 billion security budget, meaning every year the miners get paid $50 billion total,
yep.
you assume $1 million Bitcoin, you figure out how many Bitcoin are minted every year at that point, mm-hmm. and then, and I forget the mix, I think it was 40-60 between subsidy and fees, but I could look that up. Anyway, it comes out to $200 transaction fee. So, you know, you're not going to mint like every Topps baseball card for, and then trade them for, you know, for like $200 each. But for like premium art that's worth tens of thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars, then you might. Then we have to look at the economics of Bitcoin as money. And, you know, yeah, if I go to Steak and Shake, I'm not going to pay a $200 fee, obviously.
Unless it's a big order.
To buy my food. You know, but by the year, we're already seeing like tremendous innovation in layer twos, Lightning, and many other systems. That's only going to continue and continue to get better. And so by the year 2050, I hope that that would like be flourishing and that you can do pack many, many, many payments within that $200 transaction. I think things are pretty optimistic for that.
Which is more like a final settlement, like the SWIFT network kind of.
Yeah, where you're opening and closing Lightning
moving
channels.
Lightning channels like or
a single person.
A multi-party shared channel, which there's already lots of R&D happening with that today. And we're going to see that grow and we'll find problems and failure points with it and keep improving those. But so if we'd reach this world in the future in, I guess what, now like 10, 14, 15 years, where we're at $200 transactions, you know, I think we can see a world where there's like the world's demand for Bitcoin payments, it will work. This network, the Bitcoin network and the blockchain will work economically and keep, retain our censorship resistance, retain our fixed amount, you know, the monetary policy of Bitcoin won't change. We'll keep all that. Everything that Bitcoiners care about.
Yeah.
And there can be some NFTs in the blockchain and it won't inhibit that.
I think if I had to summarize everything you're just saying right there, I'm going to reframe or rephrase the Kali tweet we said last week, fees are the filter. Like to me, this is a very, very simple. It's like, it's literally like, it's very silly that this is even a debate in my mind. Like there is zero reason for this debate to exist the more I think about it. The reason is, do you believe in free markets and do you believe in subjective value or not? Full stop. Like to me, it is extremely, it's a very egotistical and simple view to say, this is what I think it should be. My view is correct. Everyone else is wrong. Says who? Why is your view special? And if your view is so special, by the way, do you have the bags to back it up and put your money where your mouth is? In my mind, if you believe that, here's another simple question for anyone that's like super deep in this debate. Do you think commerce is valuable?
Great.
Do you think that JPEGs or NFTs are valuable? Great. If you say the first is yes and the second is mostly no, then to your point, fees will solve all of this problem. Because if I'm having to pay $200, and I think that's conservative, let's call it $1,000 to put something into the blockchain or $10,000, well, I better have $10,000 per transaction. And if I do have that and I can put it in there, okay, great, then that is valuable to me subjectively. One could argue maybe the state could attack that way, but eventually, I mean, just play this out like ad absurdum, right? Like, if someone does that over and over and over and they're not creating any new value that flows back to them, eventually, if you drag it all the way to the end, they will run out of money. On the other hand, if we really believe that Bitcoin, commerce, free markets are valuable and we're not just LARPing, then every time we pay or a company pays to have a Bitcoin transaction to open and close Lightning channels, then in theory, they should be getting more value than they're putting into that system in order for that system to be sustainable and survive.
Yep.
To me, it's a very simple fees of the filter. That's the whole answer.
Also, I think it's so dangerous trying to define what spam is. I mean, you guys are already saying that, but let me give another angle on that.
Yeah.
If we take JPEGs, it's just so easy to emotionally feel and even intellectually feel like it doesn't belong in the Bitcoin blockchain. Mm-hmm. Like I think a lot of Bitcoiners emotionally and intellectually feel that way.
And I would argue that it's a blind spot.
Including myself. I kind of feel that way. However, let's take one of the other examples I gave, this Groth 16 proof. So it's a zero knowledge proof. It's a tiny piece of data because, and it's real. I mean, Citrea is going to put this in the blockchain one way or the other, whether it's like this, that, or the other technical way to achieve it, they're going to do it. I don't know what their future holds. Is it a pre-mine token? shitcoin factory probably outcome. Right. However, in the year 2050, what are the odds we have scaled payments where payments have most of the characteristics of on-chain Bitcoin, and yet it's instant settlement, it's fast, and it scales to the whole world, AI, humans, etc. And they're using zero knowledge proof technology to do it. I think the odds are high that it's that or some other equivalent type of technology. And that technology might need to put a small little proof on the blockchain, which proves millions or billions of payments. So are we going to, like, do we want to change Bitcoin so it disallows that as spam? Cutting off potential R&D paths to scale Bitcoin as money? That makes no sense at all to me.
And I agree. And I mean, again, to put this very clearly, I mean, I'm not a JPEG person myself. Like, would I buy this stuff? I think I tried it once just out of curiosity, but I have zero interest in this. I mean, again, I have friends that collect Magic the Baseball or Magic the Gathering cards. Like, would I ever do that? I find it absolutely absurd. I would never do that. However, it's like, who am I to tell my friends that their perspective, what they find value is right or wrong? Like, it's not my place. Like, it's the market's place. And so to me, what I would just say again is, like, yes, we all have emotional reactions over things. And I think a lot of that came from all of the shitcoin wars, and I get it. It's been a decade plus of crap. But at the same time, to me, it's like you either believe that commerce is valuable or you don't. I mean, if you look at, you know, all of the triggering that Ethereum and Solana, all this stuff, I don't worry about it at all. Why? Because I don't think any of that stuff is valuable. If you look over a 10-year time horizon, ETH in BTC terms is continuing to just plummet, and it's going to continue to. And that's my view or my belief, my investment thesis, because I don't think it's valuable. Short term, you can pump it with VC money. You can pump it with the state level, whatever bags, but you can't do it in perpetuity. Only way to keep funding transactions in perpetuity is you have to be getting more value out of that transaction you're putting in. And so for me, when you have these guys, oh, JPEGs can never get in there, that to me is, there's a deep-seated fear that they're afraid, wait, what if this thing actually is valuable? To me, it's not. And so I just don't worry about it.
I think there's also, like we were saying, with any technology, things have to kind of evolve, and they're not just in stasis, but I think people project, they see like, oh, if I see a JPEG taking up 50% of the block space today, imagine that in 2050. And the answer is probably don't imagine that, because it's going to evolve. So just be open to, like, whatever you see today is not stasis, or it's not project that out for decades. It's just the way it is today. And maybe that carries us through to the point where money matters more and we have more money transactions. Like, I want the money transactions. I don't care about collecting JPEGs. But like, if people want to do that now, and those things might be really valuable in 2050 when you're like, handful of JPEGs that were made in 2025 are the back in the day when you could actually do that economically. You can't do that economically anymore, right? So in a sense,
and again, you guys didn't really like speak to my point is, what, think about 100 byte proof that scales payments.
Amazing.
Yeah,
I love it.
I can't imagine someone disagreeing with that.
No,
but the whole opportune debate is around this narrow, like, that size of data. It's not JPEGs. This opportune policy has nothing to do with JPEGs. It's like from 81 bytes to like 140 some bytes is this window of data that gets
the limit allowed, is being taken off,
allowed to be transacted. Because anything above 100%. That can go to this segment, we go into the witness area. So it's these types of data. So like, I really want to understand what are people's concerns with that? I think people would say, well, Citrea is like a shitcoin VC company or whatever, and they're going to produce shitcoin. And it might very well be. But when setting up consensus rules or policy, you got to think about all the possibilities, which is a point you guys have been making, which is, both subjectivity, but also we don't know what we don't know. I think it's very reasonable to think that in like a decade's time, there will be a great payment scaling solution that uses like 100 bytes of data that needs to be put in the blockchain.
Totally.
That doesn't fit today's Satoshi's definition of a transaction. And it needs to go into like an operturn or some kind of data. And there's like that would be amazing. Like everyone wanting Bitcoin to be money, that's an amazing outcome if that happens.
I agree with you. And I just had something, it's a little spicy. And so I don't mean any offense by this, but I think it's kind of funny. I think people
that are Alex clip.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think people that are really pushing hard against it, honestly, remind me a little bit of the Greenpeace guys in a way. Like I'm not saying in the sense that I think the Greenpeace guys were poorly motivated. I think these people are honestly motivated. But it's the Malthusian delusion. It's a good term I like, the Malthusian delusion, which if you look back, I mean, Malthus, you know, he wrote whenever he was writing, 1800s, 1700s, I don't even remember.
Max is showing his intellectual prowess against us.
Absolutely flexing it. But his whole concept was
signatures.
His whole concept was that basically like the world's going to run out of resources, population, you know, we can't sustain more people. But the problem is there's been people there have been Malthuses in every generation. And the problem they always make is they can't model, to your point, in a complex adaptive system. All they're looking at is, what are the resources that we have today? What are we using today? Okay, let's just do a linear chart and see what that's going to look like in 10 years or 100 years. Problem is, the other variables in the complex adaptive system also change. Like, oh, I don't know, technology, energy sources, everything getting cheaper, stuff like you're talking about, different kinds of proofs that are going to be able to batch all kinds of payments together. And so it's the same thing when people are like, oh my God, Bitcoin, we're using 1% of the energy by 2025. It's going to be 100% of the energy. We're going to boil the oceans. And of course, that's not what happened because at the same time, the cost of solar is plummeting. The cost of batteries is plummeting. The cost of wind is plummeting. And so, you know, I don't know. I would just encourage everyone to remember in a complex adaptive system, nature is going to nature. Technology is going to solve a lot of these problems.
Malthus is going to Malthus.
Malthus is going to Malthus. Yeah.
You had some commentary on like, thank you, Max. End of clip. You had some commentary on the namespace stuff. Like, do you think that I think you said you did some back of the napkin, back of the envelope kind of calculations there. Are you generally like, believe it can fit and is not a problem?
I don't recall my numbers, okay. But I do recall, I felt like it, my back of the napkin math on how many domains, I think I probably Googled this, but like how many domains exist today? So if we think of today's world with the World Wide Web and those domains, that they could fit on the Bitcoin blockchain and I think take up, I forget what it was, but something like 5 to 10% of block space.
With one name per Bitcoin. the 2.1 like quadrillion Bitcoin.
And then
the,
a really good name.
And the fees paid were like on the order of tens of dollars per name or something. So something that's credible. Mm-hmm. Like today you go to a registrar and pay $12 or 20 or 30 or 40, whatever. So I tried to like, you know, that's the price.
Yeah.
Here's how many domains exist today. How does it fit in the blockchain? How much space does it take up? It's something like 5 to 10%. So that at least demonstrated to me like, okay, it's feasible this could happen, not get in the way of Bitcoin as money. You're crowding out maybe 5 to 10%, but it's not, I mean, something that takes 1% or 5%, sure, it affects the economics, but it's not, I mean, if it takes up 99% of the block space, then that's a very different system.
Yeah. Yeah.
and that's where I would start to get concerned about, oh, this stuff is going to crowd out Bitcoin as money. But again, it gets all about, gets back to the economics. Now, where there might be some, first of all, I might have done my napkin math wrong. But also like the future of namespace might need like orders of magnitude more names than what exists today.
Yeah. When I think about the problem, I think about domains, social media handles, and payment addresses, which you could argue are kind of like ICANN.coms, Twitter user handles, Instagram user handles, and like, you know, Venmo type,
Cash
App, PayPal, Cash App.
So,
cash tags, yeah.
So maybe one way to scale it is like, you know, sort of you have a master domain and like that goes on the blockchain. And then from that, you have many subdomains and those are stored on some other system.
Mm-hmm.
That you know has data availability risks, but is economical,
mm-hmm. like Blossom service, maybe that, which we talked about
maybe
this
that,
week.
Yeah, so maybe that's how that evolves.
Yeah,
but you know, I don't have some sophisticated model or all the answers, but I think I guess I'd encourage everyone to do the thought exercise of if we assume a world in the future where different types of information stored in the Bitcoin blockchain, what do the economics look like for each of those use cases? Which seem plausible and are that the scenario that people should be screaming about is that they come up with a good model of like NFTs or this or that or what, you know, it taking up 99% of the block space because it's willing to pay $200 or $1,000 a pop for all those transactions, crowding out the money use case. That's scary. So if someone wants to do that math and make that case, that'll get my attention and I get a lot of
people. But crowding out the money also means that they have a model for how many transactions get bundled into a given UTXO or kind of a transaction on the base layer, right?
Well, I think we must assume we're not increasing the block size. I mean, another separate exercise we can do is like, let's increase the block size. And what does that world look like? But like,
I mean, I meant 1,000 Lightning transactions that happen in
for the money use case.
Yeah.
But I mean, a challenge I'd put out there for someone is like, who's worried about JPEGs, is to come up with a scenario where they're taking up like the dominant portion of the block space, like 99% of the block space. You can calculate how many transactions that is because if my model is right, $200 per transaction, or yours $1,000, both of those are reasonable futures. That's per Bitcoin transaction where we put like 3,000 it per block. But some of these JPEGs and what people, they're literally taking the entire block space for a picture of Trump or whatever, right? So that's 3,000 times $1,000 or $3 million.
I think this is the whole answer. Who has that kind of money? So they'll have to keep doing it in perpetuity, right? So
yeah. So I'd love to see that mental exercise, and it can a plausible scenario be drawn out where non-financial data is willing to pay more than Bitcoin is money? And if yes, then I think we have a very serious problem.
Yeah. And I think as part of that, again, you'll need to explain how whoever's funding that can keep doing that. Again, short-term attacks or short-term guys made money in Ethereum, whatever, fine. But like, if you think they can keep doing that for decades, there's a reason. And the reason is they're making money out of it. That's what I would be very curious on.
And are they making money like on-chain Bitcoin money, or you're imagining they're making money
I'm imagining if you play this thing all the way out to its limit that there's only Bitcoin. So imagine the whole economy gets hyper-Bitcoinized in that world. I mean, you could do it on whatever gradation, but like imagine in that world, if I'm continuing to pay super high fees to like put, you know, if I'm willing to pay whatever it was, 1,000 times 3,000 for a Trump JPEG, like I better have some deep pockets. And if I'm going to keep doing that for years, how am I doing that? Like where is the revenue coming from? Eventually anyone, no matter how rich, even a state, will run out of money if it's not somehow replenishing the coffers too.
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue that if you're using Bitcoin as money, like I think the whole thesis, right, of Bitcoin and free markets is you pay something because you're creating more value in the world and you're capturing some of that value. I mean, this is just like basic markets, basic capitalism.
But it's always time split, right? Like the reason you have a job is because people aren't making money at the time they need to make the investment to build it.
Yeah,
right?
That's true.
So I think time is a universal... Always, yes. Piece of the money equation always. It can't be separated.
Yeah, I agree.
Should we do last topic?
No hot takes there.
What do we miss? MicroStrategy.
15 minutes.
Is MicroStrategy going to kill Bitcoin?
No. Yeah, what else can kill Bitcoin?
Yeah.
What else can kill Bitcoin? EMP?
Definitely could.
I think the topic that we might disagree on, so it'll be fun to talk about, Bitcoin treasury companies like Strategy, but more and more popping up.
Every day there's a new one.
We talked about XXI a few shows ago, I think. There's many of them. Our very first episode in November, this was our top, you know, one of our main topics. I think on that episode, I'll let you share what your view is, but my understanding of your view, Max, is Facebook should be doing this. And like highly successful, very profitable companies that have nothing to do with Bitcoin should convert their company into a strategy like, you know, levered Bitcoin play. I might be unfair in that, but that's my perception.
Mm-hmm.
What I feel like is, I think that's crazy. I think there's a case, I mean, there's like this, you know, Strategy introduced this concept in August of 2020. October 8th, I think, 2020, Block announced that it added Bitcoin to its treasury in a very different way, though. It was like something like 1% of Block's treasury was put into Bitcoin. And it's increased in value over time. I don't know, you know what the percent, I mean, the treasury's increased too. So I don't know if it's like still 1% or 5%, but it's on that order. That to me is what the guidance should be to like companies around the world, small and big, whether you're Facebook and Apple or you're a SMB, like a small, medium-sized business. It should be something like single-digit percent of your treasury in Bitcoin, and like the levered, you know, where you're selling to debt funds and equity funds, that feels like a very specialized play that I think either there's going to be a handful of winners or maybe just one that will just swallow up the smaller fish and just be one. And that could be like a strategy, an XXI, or maybe some new emerging one, but something like that. So I'm curious, what did I get wrong there? And what are your thoughts, Max?
Well, I think I've evolved a little bit. And to be clear, I wouldn't say I have like, this is 100% my thesis. I think it's also evolving. But what I would say is, first of all, I highly recommend everyone watch Saylor's last keynote speech, where he really breaks down in very like great detail what exactly MicroStrategy is doing, what the vision is. And one thing that I really took away from that talk, and he's mentioned this before, is when he presented to Microsoft. So Microsoft last year, there's a shareholder resolution saying, hey, we should explore having some amount of Bitcoin on the balance sheet. So I'm going to put the leverage aside for a second, but let's just convert any of our treasury, whether it's the Block play, a small amount or a big amount. Let's explore this. And so Saylor went and presented for 3 minutes. That was also a great presentation. And what was interesting to me is he presented a spectrum. He's like, you know, I forget all that. He had all these fun names like double maxi, triple maxi, and investor and tech guy. The point was there was like six gradations or something like that, where, you know, there was everything from a very small allocation to a medium-sized allocation to all of your treasury to a little bit of leverage to, you know, 10% leverage, 20% leverage, 30% leverage. I don't know if those numbers are exactly correct, but that's the gist of it. I think my point that I made back then was, and I guess every company and every individual is in a different position, and they should obviously understand their own capital raising, their own business, and like make their own decision. But my general take is that I don't see any reason, if you understand what's happening here, why you, like, I think almost inevitably, the further you move from like dipping your toes towards hasta los huevos, so to say, I think you're going to be rewarded more and more by the market. So for example, Block, incredible that, you know, everyone knows I'm a big Block fan. Incredible that they kicked off this movement. I would argue on the spectrum, forget leverage from it, between 1% and 100%. If they had moved from 1% to 10%, I would argue the share price would be higher today. If they had moved from 10% to 50%, I think it would still be higher. Now, obviously I'm not running the company, not sitting there, you know, understanding because I, you know, public trading, whatever. And I know you also have to have complete control, which I think Jack and one other person do. But my general point is like, I think that the further you get along that curve towards maxi and above, the more the market is going to reward you. Now, the danger here, of course, is, you know, if you start playing leverage, I think a little bit of leverage can make sense. The 10%, 20% leverage, I think the key there is transparency, knowing what you're doing. This is the key in the MicroStrategy thing, where I think he's made it very clear. We've discussed that Bitcoin would have to fall to some extremely low number of the way he's sold his debt, you know, for 5, 6, 7 years out to be $15,000 or something crazy for them to start going underwater, which, you know, you'd have to be really short Bitcoin to do. But I guess my general point is, I think on that spectrum of nothing to triple maxi, which is what Saylor is, I think every company should be several notches to the right of where they are. Now, I know your objection that you raised was, well, if I'm a Facebook or I'm an Apple or an NVIDIA, you know, it can confuse the message for investors. And I think that's fair, but I also think that investors are pretty sophisticated, the high end, you know, public equity, you know, funds. And I think they can break out the two different ideas of, okay, you've got this revenue generating business. And one of those revenue generating businesses, if you know you're saving in fiat, which is literally on fire, your options are to either do share buybacks or some kind of dividend, and they can model that, or put it into the hardest money that's ever existed, growing 30, 40, 50% CAGR, depending on your models.
So I wouldn't say everyone should have leverage, but I would say, and just as like a little window into the private world, which I think we all have a window and I have a very large window into, I would say in general, most of the companies I know are, let's say, at least 20% Bitcoin. Many are 100% Bitcoin, and many of, I think, the best ones are further to that 100% mark. Leishman, again, I think he's made an incredible sort of series noting like either believe in this stuff or you don't. And they continue to keep stacking in their balance sheet somewhere. I forgot what his number was, if it's, you know, 20%, 50%, but it's high. So I wouldn't say everyone should have leverage. I think leverage should be on the table if you're intelligent and you know what you're doing. I think Saylor certainly is in that camp. I have no idea on these new sort of SPAC-like companies. Those seem very dangerous to me just without understanding the specifics of it. Maybe each one's fine. But I think if you're here, you should probably move like five notches this way.
What are you optimizing for? Are you saying like this is sure, advice for how to get the highest market cap, highest value per share?
Value per share. So without a doubt.
Well, sorry to cut in line, but one thing I've evolved my thinking just from this conversation, so thank you, is I used to see two segments, the block strategy and the strategy.
Yeah.
But I think there's three. Mm-hmm. The simple view of this, there's three. There's the block strategy, like put a single digit percentage of your treasury in Bitcoin.
Yep.
Then what the strategy is leverage, where you literally have to go out and sell to big fund equity fund managers and debt fund managers. And that's like an entire business and financial engineering and like expertise there and relationships and
Salesforce and does that activity.
But then the middle ground is like the double digit percentage of your treasury in Bitcoin. And
that's probably what I would advocate for most.
Yeah. And so maybe where, I was saying like you're crazy or whatever is like, if everyone's doing the third segment, the leverage, you have a sales force, that's just not everyone's business, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe the more interesting debate and discussion is, should the advice to businesses be single digit or double digit percentage of your treasury? I think that's a far more interesting discussion and debate. So I feel like less strongly like, it's definitely a single digit percentage. And also there's not one right answer for every company.
Exactly.
You gave an example of Bitcoin companies or, you know, companies, you know, which I think are mostly Bitcoin companies. So
it's sample size, let's say 50.
I think it's natural for them to do double digit percentage.
Because they're dependent on Bitcoin success to succeed.
Right.
If Bitcoin fails, they fail.
Yeah.
So you could take on as much as you want, basically.
Yeah, but I would also argue, all true, but I mean, I'm extremely biased, backward and all this, but like, I would argue that they're just seeing reality more clearly and like, it's a no-brainer.
But, first of all, like the Apples and Facebooks of the world, Google, like, first of all, they're not psychologically in a position right now, or I'm speculating, but like, just based on facts and stuff that we can observe, they're not ideological about Bitcoin right now. But even if they do become that, and like Jack is, right? And Jack has been a long time. And did Jack put 100% of Block's treasury in Bitcoin?
And that's my big question. If Jack hears it's like, what if, you know, I agree, we're not going to get Apple to take that jump, but like, why is Block not 50%?
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, I agree that if Block would have done 50% back in 2020, it would have a lot more Bitcoin right now.
And it will be the same in 4 years.
It would be,
if you do it now,
it would be really interesting to know what the valuation of Block would be if we'd done that. But, if you're a company like Block, Apple, et cetera, why do you even have a treasury? Well, you have it for rainy day. You have it for M&A. You have it as a reserve in case the debt markets like change again, and you get more headwinds with the debt markets. So there's all these, and there's probably many more reasons, right? I'm not a CFO, but like those are reasons. And today in the world we live in, most of those are the liabilities are in dollars, right? So if you get to the rainy day or you get to the point where you want to do a big M&A that really changes your strategy and the future of your company, and Bitcoin price happens to be down then, well, that sucks, right? And now, of course, the Bitcoin price can be up too, and that's great. But you don't want that volatility for these use cases of your treasury. So that's why it makes no sense to me for a lot of large established businesses that aren't all about Bitcoin to have the lion's share of their treasury.
You're valuing the company based on the economic engine they built that generates cash that they can invest to amplify the generation of cash in the future. So if they know for sure what that future is, the future is Bitcoin and they can see it clearly, what I would want them to do if I were a shareholder of them, I want you to buy back use all of your US dollars, don't buy any Bitcoin, buy back all your shares, make my share price go up, and then let me either sell those shares or lever them for me to buy Bitcoin. That's what I want to happen. It's very simple to say, like, see it clearly, break it out, and this company generates cash. And I don't invest in them partially because they have this like Bitcoin exposure and partially because they have this economic engine they built. I invest in them because of the economic engine. And then I make my Bitcoin investments separately. And I can use that as an asset or collateral to make more Bitcoin investments. But mixing them doesn't buy anybody anything.
So I would just, have you watched the Saylor Talk?
I don't know that I have.
I would strongly recommend everyone watch the Saylor Talk. My point is, I get what you're saying.
But take what you learned, though, and
refute
what he said. Because what he said is very logical to me.
I get it. And what I would say to that is, and I don't think we're going to have time to do the full discussion on the show today.
Okay, backpedaling.
No. But, well, I think that's old world thinking. I really do. And I think the question is, I think we want to have a much longer conversation of what is finance? What evaluations look like on a Bitcoin standard? And I would say everything you're saying is correct pre-Bitcoin. And what I would say now is if I know that you can build a machine that's going to generate money, which is what I think of a company is, and I know you have two options. You have an option to save in one thing, which I know is volatile to the downside. And like, I know the inverse, the negative CAGR that is versus an asset that I know, yes, volatility short term, but one, that's also mitigated by the ability to borrow against that now, which is really helpful with stuff like Lava. But I know the CAGR on that is 20, 30, 40%. Then I have two options. Will my money machine that spits out more Bitcoin be more valuable, or the money machine that spits out something that's devaluing? That's my general take.
I actually think we're all in agreement. Here's how we tie all this together.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of timing. So if we look at the next 20 years, the small businesses of the world who are ideological about Bitcoin see the future.
Right.
Bitcoin companies, those are the ones today that have 50 to 100% of their treasury in Bitcoin. And then you have the blocks of the world, and Coinbase's have a small percentage of their treasury in Bitcoin, but they got off zero.
Right.
And then fast forward a few years, it's going to be like a lion's share of the small businesses that will have Bitcoin. And then the Apples of the world will have 1% to 5%. And then if you fast forward 10, 15 years from now, 20 years from now, as the world shifts to hyper-Bitcoinization, it's just everyone's rising. It's just it's just phases.
Yep.
So because the Apples of the world do have to deal with the reality that the liabilities they pay today are dollars.
Totally.
In 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, I don't know, you know, long term, those liabilities will switch into Bitcoin.
And I guess what I would just say that, just to be clear, I mean, I definitely get your point if every investor is sort of already orange-pilled as well. And what I would just say is that most people that are buying Apple are not Bitcoiners yet. Like, they're not going to do what you're saying. But if I'm Apple and I realize, and it's also to be clear, I get your point, they have to pay things for dollars in dollars. But if I do start to understand that I can, you know, maybe they start with 1% and then they start moving slowly there. Although I think they should just go deeper if they understand what's actually happening, but whatever, you gotta shift the opening to window over time. I do think the tech companies that make this move first, my hypothesis, are going to radically outperform the others. Because at first there will be some question, but if I know whatever, Meta is spitting off this much cash, Apple is spitting off this much cash, I hold that stock for 4 years and I see this is what it resulted in, just stock buybacks versus, you know, or maybe they have a new idea, but very few companies have new ideas. Block is one exception because it's founder led. They do actually have new ideas, which maybe that's a little bit different. But if they don't have like truly radical new ideas, then I think those companies that save in money that goes up 20, 30, 40% CAGR are going to radically outperform the others. That's my hypothesis.
But then I think, I just want to sell that stock and I want to either buy MicroStrategy if I really understand it.
Yeah.
Or I want to buy Bitcoin, but I don't want to have this like thing that's exposed to the idiosyncrasies of the mobile phone market.
If I believe that Apple is still a great business, like I want to own Apple because I believe people are going to keep buying.
If you think people are
going
to buy iPhones, then invest in it. And management should not hold Bitcoin in treasury and should give you exposure to, will people buy mobile phones in the future?
A little bit of pushback, though, David, is that, I mean, the argument you're making has been made before. Independent of Bitcoin, right?
Yeah.
A very classic argument between shareholders and companies is, why are you holding all these dollars on your balance sheet?
Yeah.
And like, you know, for a long time, Apple paid no dividend and Google paid no, does Google pay a dividend?
A little bit,
today?
Yeah.
They do now? Yeah. Small, but I mean, like, you know,
it's minor.
And they just accumulated like hundreds of billions of dollars. Yep. And so then people like pay a dividend or buy back shares or whatever. And over time they do that. But that is a classic argument that's been had for decades.
Sure, yeah.
And it's a similar argument. Because
I think it's different because you're not assuming that if I hold cash, that cash is going to go up in value by 10x, and now all my shareholders are going to be happy that I grew the value. It's the optionality that you pointed out. I have the optionality to make good M&A decisions, right? I have the optionality to do a future buyback of shares. But those are the kinds of decisions, like the characteristic of decisions that would be valuable for that management team to make. I don't want that management team telling me their opinion about the fact that Bitcoin's good or not. Like, I believe Bitcoin's good, but it's not really up to them to express that idea to me. It's up to them to run that business well.
Well, I mean, I just want to push back on this because I think that I'm not necessarily saying that you have to believe Bitcoin's going to 10x. What I'm saying is if I know there's a business that's an incredible money machine and one of those businesses can store monopoly pieces of paper or they can store in gold, I know where I'd want them to store the money. It's completely independent of them making iPhones. And what I would say is,
what about the Monopoly community card with the gold?
Well, what I would say is, like, and I think Saylor says it very beautifully, every company, every individual, every organization, every country has the opportunity to merge with the Bitcoin network. When they merge with the Bitcoin network, they're saving in something that goes up over value in value over time versus not. And I would also say that I think you're absolutely right that, you know, you don't want them necessarily going, you know, hasta los huevos on Bitcoin. But now that you can lend or you can borrow against Bitcoin with stuff like dollars, as long as, you know, you're, again, being intelligent about it, I don't see any risk in how that's going to hurt your M&A strategy.
I'm just saying, I understand Bitcoin, so I don't want to own these things that are partial Bitcoin exposure things.
But
if it's like exposure to the search engine market or cloud computing or mobile phone market, get me that exposure. I would prefer to have no exposure to any of that stuff. And just exposure to Bitcoin, like that's rational to me. But then to mix it is what's problematic.
So let me reframe this one way that makes sense. To be clear, I mean, so I obviously from your perspective, I know how you allocate that, which is good. But from the perspective of if I'm Tim Cook, right? Like, I'm not thinking, is David King going to buy this stock? I'm thinking, how do I juice the price of Apple as much as humanly possible? Now, let me ask this another way. Imagine there was a hyper successful company selling the best wine and the best beef in Argentina. And they tell you, hey, don't worry, we don't want to take a position here. We're going to store in pesos because that's what we do. We're an Argentinian company. Absolutely not. Of course they wouldn't do that. They store in dollars. Why do they store in dollars? Because they can store monopoly money or something that's more gold-like. I would argue it's the exact same thing. Spicy.
Maybe you wrap it. Well, I'm glad we had a little bit of disagreement among each other. But good discussion. And I think we're going to continue this discussion in the future because all of us are interested in envisioning a hyper-Bitcoinized world where Bitcoin is the standard and everyday money, it's gold, it's, you know, it's everything. And what are the credit and debt markets look like in that world? It's very fascinating. I don't think anyone like knows the exact answer. So let's talk about that
in
the future.
And I think PE
episode.
Ratios are a shitcoin.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's something I can agree with.
So we'll talk about that in the future.
All right.
Tune back in.
Great show, guys.
All right. Good. PB Hackathon tonight.
Tonight. AI.
All right.
Bye, everyone.